I think this is going to be the most mathematical talk, so I warn you of that. If you don't like mathematics, kind of like close my eyes and you can leave or something. Okay, so I'm going to talk about convergent graph sequences, which is, we've had a long project on this, the five of us. We've been working on it for about 4 years since we asked Lotze, how do the combinatorialists take a limit of a sequence of growing graphs? Since coming from the math physics side, whenever you have, you know, a statistical mechanical system or something, you just take its limit. Everybody knows how to do that. You learn that in your first course. And he said, well, there isn't a standard way of people doing that. So we started to do that. And since then, a lot of other groups have started to do it in their own ways also. And it's taken us a long time to write it because we're all older mathematicians. Christian is the youngest of the bunch. So I'm actually going to focus on dense graph sequences, which is most of what we know about, and there are two parts to the talk corresponding to two long papers that we have. One has to do with, what we wanted to do was we wanted to figure out a natural notion, a notion that wasn't too strong, okay? We didn't want all graph sequences to converge to the same point and wasn't too weak. We didn't want all graph sequences to converge to different points. And so we came up with what we thought were some natural notions, and in the process we showed that all of these notions were really the same as each other. So there are lots of different things that come in. Okay, so the first part, I'll give you the motivation, which I've given you a little bit. Then I'll talk about convergence and testing. Our first notion of graph convergence has to do with subgraph densities, and from this we come up with a notion which we call left convergence. Then what we wanted to do to try to see what this had to do with other natural notions, we came up with a metric to measure how far one graph is from a second graph. Okay, and you could come up with lots of notions of a metric. We wanted one that would actually help us get from one natural notion to another natural notion. And then we have, once we come up with this metric, then we say what it means for a graph sequence to converge in that metric. Then I'm gonna talk about what's called the Semmeretti lemma and sampling. And if you come from the math physics side, it's kind of a renormalization. It's a way of looking at a graph on a large scale and seeing properties of that graph on a large scale. And this is a very, very, very important lemma. A lot of people are using it in number theory now and in a lot of other areas. Actually, it came up first in the context of number theory. And sampling I'll talk about also. And then this is a notion from theoretical CS, a notion of testing. And then I'll talk about the limit object, metric convergence, and testability. Okay, and that's all the first part of the talk. Second part shorter. Okay, so there are many examples of growing graph sequences. There's the internet, the World Wide Web, social networks. I should say to Walter, I'm not trying to model any of them. Ultimately, I would like to model some of them, but the math is much harder for these than for the kinds of graphs that we will deal with. Okay, so what we want is we want a brief but faithful representation of a graph so that we can test properties of that graph, like clustering. If we have the World Wide Web and we want to look at clustering on it, we don't want to have to look at the whole web. We want to be able to take a sample of it and do some clustering on that. Or we want to be able to take a sample of it and come up with a search algorithm on it, or a sample of the internet, and come up with a routing algorithm on that. So here I'm only going to deal with dense graphs, which has already taken us the better part of 4 years to do. We we've got some results for sparse graphs, but they are bounded, they're bounded degree sparse graphs. So it doesn't cover the World Wide Web, things like that. Okay, so we're given a sequence of graphs with the number of nodes of the graph tending to infinity. And the questions we ask, well, what is the right notion of convergence? As I said, we don't want it too strong, we don't want it too weak. And then, is there a useful metric? I used to just say, is there a metric? And Bela Bolabash pointed out to me that once I have one notion of convergence, I can always come up with a metric, which is a tautology for that. And so that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a useful metric such that once I come up with one natural notion of convergence, it'll also be Cauchy in that metric. And then what is the limit object?
Question?
Yeah.
So with your graphs, do you have additional structure like edge lengths and things of that sort? Or is
nothing.
It just okay.
Nothing. Yes. These are completely general dense graphs. And I'm actually ultimately going to be looking at weighted graphs, graphs with self-loops. My sequence can... you know, can be anything, so it doesn't have to look like it's settling down at first. Okay, so testing is a whole big area of CS, and so a simple graph parameter is a real valued function on simple graphs. A simple graph has no self edges, no loops, as the graph theorists call it, and it only has one edge, one edge running from node A to node B. And I want it to be invariant under isomorphism, okay? And then, okay, what would you want for something to be testable? So let's think of something like the triangle density of a graph. What you would hope is that if you took a sample of that graph and a random sample, uniformly random sample, of a large enough size, and you took your function, like the triangle density, and you evaluated it on that sample graph. So I pick some subset of k points, and I look at the graph that I get on those k points, the induced graph on those k points, and I look at the triangle density on that smaller graph. I would hope that if k is large enough, if I've taken a large enough uniform sample, then the measurement on that sample is going to be close to the measurement on the full graph with large probability. Okay, so that's what it means for something to be testable, that if you test it on a uniform sample, it's going to be close to the answer you would get on the full graph with large probability. Okay? So one of the classic examples of this is the max cut density, and so this was a big deal, I guess, about 10 years ago or so, a little more than that. And so one question that we have is testability related to a reasonable notion of graph convergence, and how do testable parameters behave on a convergent sequence of graphs? Okay, so a preview is that there will be a reasonable notion of a convergent graph sequence, and it will turn out to be the same as convergence in a very nice metric, and it will be closely related to testability. Yeah?
So with regard to testability, you don't require that the function is somehow equal to a boundary.
No.
No.
I mean, the max cut density, for example, is not easy to evaluate. So all that I want is that it is a simple graph parameter, which means that it's invariant under a relabeling of the points of my graph. Okay, so some of the main theorems of part one will be that with the notion that we'll come up with, a function, a simple graph parameter, will be, so this function of the convergent sequence will converge if and only if this function is essentially continuous in the metric. I'll tell you what I mean by that. If and only if it's testable, and if and only if if and only if we can extend it to a continuous function on the limit object. Okay, so I've been telling you about all these very vague things. Let me give you a definition of one notion one notion of a convergent graph sequence. So I want F and G to be simple graphs, so this means no self loops and only one edge per pair. And for part one, I want to think of F as small and G as large. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at maps that map the small graph into the large graph such that the nearest neighbors of the small graph, such that you will find the nearest neighbors of the small graph in the large graph, okay? So a homomorphism just will give you the nearest neighbors, okay? So for example, I could think of F as a triangle, okay? And I'm trying to look at, well, what I'm gonna wanna look at actually is the number of these maps. The number of these maps, if F is a triangle, will grow like N, the number of points in G, cubed, because I have three edges. So I want to normalize that by N to the minus 3, okay? And so as I said, this would be like the triangle density, okay? And so I could do this for lots of different graphs. I could do this for an edge, for a triangle, for a four-cycle, for a Peterson graph, and what if all of these converged? To us, we would think that this is a very natural notion of graph sequence converging. If the density of edges, the density of triangles, the density of four cycles, the density of any finite graph settles down. Okay, so that's our first notion. We say that a graph is left convergent if all of these densities settle down for all simple graphs F, like an edge, a triangle, a four-cycle. Okay, so for example, if we have the standard random graph, so the Erdős-Rényi random graph, this will converge, and it will converge to P, the density of the Erdős-Rényi graph, to the number of edges in F. So if F is just one edge, it'll converge to P. If it's a triangle, then it'll converge to P cubed.
Shouldn't that be 1 minus the number of edges converging to stuff?
No.
You just have to be as a subgraph.
Just as a subgraph. So you could come up with other notions like rather than seeing it as a standard kind of an induced subgraph, you could have different kinds of things. So you could have an injective mapping and things like that, and you could get a Möbius transformation with inclusion exclusion that would take you back and forth from one to the other. Okay, so graph metrics. So first I'll talk about something that's called the cut norm on a matrix, and then I will use that to come up with a distance from one graph to another if they're on the same number of nodes, okay, same number of vertices. Then I'll talk about splitting vertices and use that to come up with a metric that will compare two graphs that are not on the same number of nodes. Because obviously, if we want a graph sequence, we have to be able to compare graphs which are on different numbers of nodes. Okay, so the cut norm on a matrix. So Fries and Kanin in 1999 looked at just a square matrix, and they said the cut norm of this matrix is given by the maximum over all subsets S and T of the sum of the MIJ. So this is finding basically the maximum cut in the matrix. Okay, and you could just look at S and S complement. They don't have to be disjoint, no. Okay, but I do want to maximize it, so. Okay. So, okay, now I'm going to talk about weighted graphs, okay? So far I was talking about a simple graph G, but now I'm going to talk about a weighted graph G in which the vertices have weights. So to a physicist, this should not seem so strange. There are reasons why you would want to put a weight on a given vertex. And certainly the edge weights need not just be zero or one, okay? And even in Mark Newman's talk, you know, we were realizing that the kinds of things that he was coming up with would be more useful if he were doing it on a weighted graph. And I think a lot of what he talked about would probably have gone through for a weighted graph. But you might say, okay, in a social network, if people send, you know, 10 pieces of email back and forth, that edge should be 10 rather than just one if they send one piece of email back and forth, okay? And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the standard adjacency matrix, which is usually just zeros and ones, but I'm going to put in for the ijth element the weights of the I node and the j node and the edge weight going from I to j. Okay? And I'm going to say that the distance from one graph to another graph is the cut norm of the difference between the weighted adjacency matrices. Okay? So what I'm doing is I'm saying if I look at these two graphs, if I look at the adjacency matrices of these two graphs and I subtract them from each other, this is on the same number of nodes, what is the maximum difference in the cuts that I can get? Okay? And it turns out that this is a really useful notion. A lot of people have been studying cut norms. They turn out to be related to Grothendieck norms and all kinds of very interesting things in math.
If g is equal to g prime with the same weights, does this mean zero?
Okay. If they are labeled the same way, yes. Okay, so I'm going to take care of that in a minute. Okay? Yeah? And I'm going to do that right now. So note that it is not invariant under isomorphisms. So I'm going to do an integer overlay, and I'm going to minimize over all relabelings. Okay? And now, both of you guys should be happy, because what I had before would have given me a non-zero distance here. But obviously, these are the same graph. So now I'll get a zero distance. Okay?
On the previous slide, when you put square bracket,
The integer set from 1 to n. Sorry, yeah, that's the graph theorist's notation, yeah.
And you required the vertex weights to be equal.
Here, the vertex weights were equal. So far, yes. Okay, so far. But I'm gonna, but I'm not gonna require
with that when you relabel your vertices.
Okay. I'm in a moment going to have a generalization of this where the vertex weights need not be the same, okay? But when I relabel them, if this one had a much higher weight than these two, I would want this. So here, the relabeling would take that into account.
So okay? You're only allowed to relabel vertices which have the same.
Which have the same weight. But in a moment, I'll give you a way of dealing with it if they don't have the same weights. Okay? And at the same time, I'll give you a way of dealing with it if they don't even have the same number of vertices. Okay? So, what do we do if they have different numbers of vertices? What I'm going to do is, so let's say that there are n vertices of g and n prime vertices of g prime, and I'm going to split each vertex of g into n prime vertices, and split each vertex of g prime into n vertices, okay? So I'm going to duplicate them. And now let's look at a graph g with weights alpha I and beta ij. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to split the ith vertex into n prime pieces. So let's say that g prime had three vertices, okay? Then I'm going to take each of the vertices of g and I'm going to split it into three vertices, duplicated three times, okay? And I'm also going to have to, and this will account for how I do the overlay if they're not the same, I'm going to have to split the weight of the vertex I into three pieces, okay? So, for example, here, rather than, you know, so if this is the total weight of the vertex I, let's say that I'm going to give less of it to the first one, a little more of it to the second one, and over half of it to the third one. Okay? So for each exine, set of exine mu's, I would have a different way of assigning the weight alpha I to the three new vertices. Okay? So, and then I have to tell you what to do with the edges of it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to replace the edge ij by a complete bipartite graph on, okay, so now think of g prime as having three vertices. So I'm going to take my one edge of g, and I'm going to, and this vertex has been split into three vertices there. They might have different weights. This vertex has been split into three vertices. So what do I do with my edges now? I just put edges in every way that I can from the i's to the j's, a complete bipartite graph. And I'm going to give each of these edges the weight of that edge. Okay? And it turns out it's not at all hard to verify that the new graph that I get on n times n prime vertices is going to have the same subgraph densities. Okay? So what happens is that this guy that's been split in all these funny ways is going to have the same triangle, the same edge density, the same triangle. Same four-cycle density. Okay? It's independent of how I split it. That's why I'm doing this.
How can I have the same K3-3 density? You just added a bunch more K3-3.
But you divide
but
by
I normalize.
But
I normalize.
By 3n to the...
Because this thing, it's not the same number of K3-3s. It's the same density of K3-3s. So now I'm going to divide by n times n prime to the number of
six,
the number of edges in your K3-3. So n times n prime. Pardon?
Example, that has four cycles, but the original graph didn't, because it didn't have four sites.
What do you
say? I'm looking at the right and I'm seeing four cycles, but I'm looking at the left and I don't see any four cycles because there's only two sites.
No, homomorphisms allow you to map into the same vertex.
They're just adjacency preserving maps. They're not isomorphisms.
Okay.
They're homomorphisms.
I'm understanding. So what is being preserved? Certainly not the number of four cycles, because on the left there aren't any. And on the right there are.
The number, okay. It is.
Or the density.
It's the density of four cycles. The density of maps, okay, the number of adjacency preserving maps from a four cycle into my graph properly normalized.
Okay,
is being
so
preserved.
On the left I would not exactly interpret that as the four cycle density.
It's not the injective density. You're right, it's a Mobius transformation away from the injective density.
I can map 1 to I, 2 to J, 3 to I, 4 to J. Then I get a four cycle. That's a homomorphism.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah? So, okay, so cut metrics between arbitrary graphs. So now I have graphs with different alpha I, beta I j, alpha I prime, beta I j prime, and I'm asking that the total weight be the same, which I can just do by normalizing. And our cut metric is the minimum over all fractional overlays, that is all coupling. So these guys, these xi mu, which tell me how I take the one vertex weight and I divide it up among all the other weights. And for a probabilist, this is just a coupling because the marginals of it, when I sum over the u's, I get the alpha i's, and when I sum over the i's, I get the alpha primes. Okay? And to an analyst, as Terry just told me yesterday, this is called a joining, not a coupling. But it's the same thing. The marginals are the, right? Okay, so I'm minimizing over all of these. Just as with the isomorphisms, because there were two people here who got very upset, and they should have been said, but things that should be zero distance are not zero distance, so I should overlay these things differently. This is a way of trying to do fractional overlays. Yeah?
Just for clarification, so you simply count homomorphism, right? So
mm-hmm.
for the subgraph, your F graph, if the number of vertices are the same for like F and F prime, but F prime has more isomorphism.
More homomorphisms, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you do this splitting, to use the previous metric, you need the weights equal. And so now the splitting has to
no.
be the vertex weights, the x's, somehow have to match up.
They
but
sum
they
to the same amount.
No, they're the same x.
Mm-hmm.
X, I use now the black.
Because of this.
You see, the g of x is now a vertex on n times n prime. It's a graph on n times n prime vertices.
Yeah.
And this has
vertex. And this one is on n times n prime vertices.
And both
too.
Have vertex weights x I u.
They're both, now that we've taken G, now that we've taken G and we blew it up by duplicating everything by N prime, and we took G prime and we duplicated everything by N, they have the same number of vertices.
Sure. Now it's the
and the
vertex
weights are right.
I'm worried about
the vertex weights are right because it's a coupling. If the marginals were not right, the vertex weights would not be right.
If he wonders whether there's a same, not just as I write.
Same.
Because that G of X and G prime of X have the same vertex weight.
Which they do.
Because
if the graphs have the same size, is it the same as the is it delta tilde?
Is it the same?
No.
Is this the same as the delta tilde? This easily does the regular isomorphism also.
Yeah.
I mean, this
yeah.
minimum does the regular. It's a stupid way of doing it if I have the same number of vertices.
But it could be smaller.
Right.
So
and you can't prove it.
And we have actually, we have bounds in the two directions of like 167. We spent about a month trying to prove that they were the same. Just not that
so
it was necessary for anything, but they should be the same.
The same at least up to constant.
No, we can prove that one is to the power 167 of the area, which is, I mean, and there was no reason we needed it except it just seems so obvious that they should be the same up to a constant.
So it's an equivalent metric.
We think it's an, yes. As a metric, it's equivalent. The measure that's induced by it is yes. Okay. So, this is the metric. Okay, so convergence in metric. I say that a graph is convergent in metric if it's a Cauchy sequence in the metric. So if as you go further and further out along the sequence, they get closer and closer. And our first theorem is that a sequence of simple graphs is left convergent, that is the subgraph densities converge, if and only if it's convergent in the cup metric. So these things don't seem like the same. Okay, but it turns out that they are. Okay, if it converges, if the subgraph frequencies converge, then it's convergent in this cup metric and vice versa. Okay, so that's what I just said. Okay, so the Semmeretti lemma and sampling. Okay, so given a simple unweighted graph G, I'm going to look at a disjoint partition of the vertex set. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to think of taking my vertex set of G and taking Q colors and coloring each vertex one of these Q colors, okay? So if it has the I color, then it's in the I color class. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the edge density from red vertices to blue vertices, and I'm going to say that's the number of edges from the red vertices to the blue vertices properly normalized, okay? And I'm going to say that my average graph has node weights 1 and has the average edge density. Okay? So, so here I take, you know, I take all the edges from the red vertices to the blue vertices, and I replace them by the average value. Okay? And the Semmeretti regularity lemma, and I think this is the easiest statement of it, in the weak form proved by Fries and Kanin, actually tells us that the distance, this cut metric distance from a simple graph to its average is very small if we take a large enough number of colors. Okay, so the weak regularity lemma, and the original form of it was not an average form. It talked about that most pairs of colors were right, and this is just saying that the average over all the color classes is right. So if I want to get a graph having a cut distance that's smaller than epsilon from its average, then if I take at most 4 to the 1 over epsilon squared colors, I can do this. Okay, this looks pretty big, but Tim Gower actually has examples that you need things this big. And actually, if you do not the average, but the more precise Semmeretti lemma, you get these horrible towers, and he's got examples that some of those are actually necessary. They're not easy examples. What? What? This is all for dense graphs. We're talking about, the whole talk has to do with dense graphs. People have tried to come up with a Semmeretti lemma for sparse graphs. It's much, much harder. A lot of people are trying to do that. Okay, so sampling. So here's our main technical lemma. And what it says is that if I have two graphs and I want to look at their distance in the cut metric, okay, let's say that they're huge graphs, and I just don't want to do this, okay? So let me take a sample of each graph and look at the distance of these smaller graphs from each other. And how accurate will that be? Well, I'm telling you that if you take samples which are of size k, then I can get them up to 1 over 4th root of k, okay, with a very large probability. Okay, and Alon and Fernandez de la Vega and Cunnan and Karpinski have something like this with a different k dependence and a different proof in a totally different context in 2003. Okay, so our second theorem has to do with the closeness of the sample. So let's think again. I don't want to deal with these huge graphs, okay? So if I take a sample of my graph, how close is that in the cut metric to the graph that I really care about? And if I take a sample of size k, using that previous lemma in a way that I'll talk about, I can get these two very, very close to each other, not as close as the last time, but 1 over square root of log with a large probability. Okay? So the key elements of the proof of theorem 2. Okay, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use an easy sampling argument. So what if my graph were already its own average? Okay? Let's say that I could divide my graph up into color classes where everything was constant. Well, then an easy sampling argument would say that I could prove the theorem because then everything's constant in between the color classes. Okay, then I'm going to use the weak regularity lemma to take my arbitrary graph and say, well, it's pretty close to a constant graph. And how close? Well, I'm going to use that technical lemma to show how much I lose by doing that. Now, the proof of all of this is probably like 30 pages or something, so it's a little harder than it sounds. So the proof of theorem 1 then is, so what theorem 1 is saying is that the convergence of the subgraph densities is the same as the convergence in the cut metric. So by the triangle inequality, that theorem which said that I can get myself very close to in cut metric to a sample, tells us that two graphs are close in metric if and only if their samples are close. And then this is the main point. Knowledge of subgraph frequencies is very close to knowledge of the sampling probabilities. Okay, the density of, let's say, a 4-cycle in G is close to the probability that that if I sample, I'm going to see a four-cycle. Okay? Okay, and here I'm really shoving under the rug the difference between, you know, the homomorphisms that we've got and various kinds of injective homomorphisms and things like that and Mobius transformations. And this is the part that's lots of work. The convergence of the subgraph frequencies is then the same as convergence in the metric.
Is there an easy way to see why all this should fail for the sparse graphs, or is it because of technology?
You can't even use the same definition of the subgraph frequencies for sparse graphs. Like, how would I normalize the sparse graphs? Okay, I wouldn't normalize by n cubed for a triangle.
What's the triangle density on the triangular lattice?
We've got some results actually for sparse graphs. We've got some results for sparse graphs with different definitions of what it means to be left convergent with it, but they require cluster expansions and all kinds of things, and they're not as not as broad as these. But you really have to know something about what's.
For example, there's no Semmelweis dilemma; it's just not known. Probably just the theory.
Right. There's people have tried to come up with useful Semmelweis dilemmas for sparse graphs, but Semmelweis is telling you because you have so many edges around, you can look at things in an average sense, and you don't have so many edges around on a sparse graph. Okay, so this is just telling you once more what it means to be testable. So a testable graph parameter is one that if I evaluate it on a sample, I can get it close to the evaluation on the whole graph with large probability by taking the sample margin. Okay, so our third theorem says that if F is a bounded simple graph parameter, then it turns out that F being testable is the same as F being convergent, left convergent. Okay, so F converges on a sequence of graphs if and only if the subgraph densities converge. And this is basically continuity in the metric. If I didn't have this condition here that these two had to be large enough, then it would be continuity in the metric. So what this says is that if I want my function to be close, then if the two graphs are close in the cut metric, then the functions are close on those graphs. Okay, so it's continuity in the metric, except for this little condition here, which we need. Okay, so an example of a testable graph parameter. Well, all of the subgraph frequencies are testable graph parameters, okay? Triangle density, four-cycle density, etc. And by part two of the talk, every bias multi-way max cut density is a testable graph parameter. Mark Newman, in his talk, talked about max cuts. He also talked about min cuts. You know, and he said, well, he wants his algorithm to figure out what is the relationship here. You know, sometimes it's a min cut, sometimes it's a max cut. It might be something else. It might be breaking it up into many different pieces. Okay, all of the biased multi-way max and min cut densities and everything in between them are also testable graph parameters. So if Mark wanted to do his process on a dense graph, this would be saying that he would be okay in sampling. Okay? Okay, so the limit object. So theorem one says that a sequence of graphs is left convergent only if it's convergent in the metric. So of course this means that there exists a limit object, but is there a useful representation of the limit object? Okay. A limit object, you know, means nothing, right? And the answer is yes, and we call it the graphon. So a function from the unit square to the reals is a graphon if it's a measurable function, a symmetric function, and a bounded function. And so what I'm going to think of, actually, is I'm going to think of taking the graph and writing out the adjacency matrix of the graph, and then using that as kind of a step function, okay, on the square. And then as my limit goes on, the grid is going to be getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and it's going to be converging to one of these graphons. Okay, so as I said, a step function is an example of a graphon, a step function on the square. If I had something on two vertices, it would just be, you know, on the unit square, just split, and right, and I would, if I had, you know, this graph with weights 1 and 1, then it would be 1, 1, and then 1, 0, okay? And then my function, the graphon, would just have weight 1 here, weight 0 here, weight 1 here, weight 1 here, okay?
Oh, can you remind us what measurable means?
Pardon?
Can you remind us what measurable means?
What measurable means? Oh my God. Okay, I'm being very sloppy here. I mean, I need to give you a measure and I need, okay, I need to give you a measure space and I need to give you a measure on that space. So measure means, there are sets, it's better to think of what's not measurable, okay? Sets that are so crazy that you can't cover them in any nice way, okay, as you take limits, are not measurable. What's a classic, and then I have to tell you with respect to what measure things are not measurable. So somebody give me a hand here. What's a, what? Thank you. Inner measures, outer measures, balls coming up or surrounding things.
Unions of boxes in just the uniform measure, uniform measure of the square, it limits of sequences, unions of boxes.
But you don't have to worry about them because they don't exist.
That said, we spent 3 hours yesterday talking to Terry Tao about non-measurable null sets that were driving him crazy and us crazy in this stuff. But anyway, they don't exist, but they drive you crazy.
So the values of this function W are probably, I guess I can think of as my edge weights.
Yes, absolutely.
And what about my vertex weights? Where did those go?
Let's think for now of no vertex weights. Okay, you can put them.
If you have a step function, see, so you don't divide it evenly, that way. So you divide it wider and smaller into the next column.
Okay, so here this vertex. Okay, this guy has 3/4 of my weight. This guy has 1/4 of my weight. So now this guy has weight 3. This guy has weight 1. And now this is how it looks. Okay. Okay. So graphons is limit objects. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to define my subgraph frequency as taking this function, taking the product of this function over all of the edges. Okay, thinking of these as edges. And the theorem of Lovaas and Balázs, Balázs-Szigeti, is that G is left convergent if and only if there's a graphon that this converges to.
So you really don't want W to be negative.
No. Don't want W to be negative. Okay. So Fries and Kanin actually, in a different context, talked about the cut norm of a graphon. Okay, in the same paper in which they came up with a cut norm of a matrix. So this is just taking subsets of 0, 1 and taking that cut. And so our theorem in the graphon language is that GN is left convergent, subgraph frequencies converge, if and only if there's a graphon and a relabeling of G such that the step function, which is a graph basically, converges to this graphon in the cut metric. Okay? Our theorem 3 in the graphon language is that a simple graph parameter is testable if and only if it has a continuous extension on graphons. That is, this function is a continuous function in the cut metric. And the function on graphs goes to the extension on the graph on step function, as this tends to infinity. And then summary of part one, and I'll then very quickly do part two for you, but there is a reasonable notion of convergent graph sequences, that is the convergence of the subgraph densities, which turns out to be the same as convergence in the cut metric and is closely related to sampling and to testability. Okay, so these are just the main theorems, so and you've basically seen them. Okay, so in part one, we learned that a graph sequence can be probed from the left, we call it, by studying the density of subgraphs that I'm in. Okay, so the homomorphisms of some little graph into my big graph G. If instead I looked at the homomorphisms of my big graph into some little graph, that would be doing colorings or statistical mechanics or multi-way cuts. So in part two, we're going to learn that GN can be probed from the right by studying colorings, multi-way cuts, or statistical mechanical models, and it gives us a dual notion of what it means for graphs to converge. So, talk about homomorphisms into small weighted graphs, then our first stab at what it means for something to be right convergent in terms of ground state energies, why that's not good enough, then microcanonical ensembles and a better notion of what it means to be right convergent, and then the full equivalences. Okay, so in part one, we looked at homomorphisms of little graphs into big graphs. And now what I want to do is I want to consider homomorphisms of my big graph into a little graph which is weighted. Okay, so it has vertex weights and it has edge weights. So the number of homomorphisms of G into H is going to be the product of the vertex weights times the product of the edge weights. So basically what I'm doing is I'm counting the number of weighted colorings. So if this is my little graph, okay, then this is just the independent set model. The number of independent sets, because I say it's like one, the red sites can't be near themselves, the blue sites can't be near themselves, but the red sites can be next to the blue sites. Okay? So why don't I put a loop? Right. So the independent set model, sorry, is that an empty set can be next to itself. So I'm going to make that the empty set. Okay? But these are generalized coloring models, so let me give you an example.
Unweighted.
Pardon?
G is unweighted, yeah.
G is unweighted. So the easing magnet, so the alphas are going to be the fields and the betas are going to be the couplings. And the number of homomorphisms of G into H is going to be just the sum over the homomorphisms of the energy of the homomorphism, where this is the energy, it's just your standard easing model energy.
The
now, you should note that, yeah? It definitely knows about the weights. Here we go. Here. These are the weights of H. So it knows about, so here I'm taking H to be weighted. Before, F was not weighted. Now H is weighted, and this is the homomorphism. These are the weights here.
Yeah, but the homomorphism itself doesn't know anything about weights, right?
Of course it does.
Right. The homomorphism doesn't have the weights, but you weight.
But the weighting, but each homomorphism is weighted by.
So it's a weighted count.
It's a weighted count, yes. It counts, it's not enough, it's a weighted count of the colorings. Yes, you're right. The weighted should be there. You're totally right. Weighted should be there. Okay. So, note that this is not the conventional normalization of the energy for a dense graph, because if I had a dense graph, then I should divide this by the number of nodes in G, okay? Like in the easing model on the complete graph, I should divide this by n. So the homomorphisms here are going not like e to the n, but like e to the n squared, okay? So naive right convergence. So what I'm going to do, since it's going like e to the n squared, I'm going to divide it by n squared. And note again that it's not the free energy because I didn't normalize the energy properly. And our definition is that G is naively right convergent. We first tried to say that this was right convergent, but then as we tried to do things, we realized that it was too naive. If it converges for all soft core weighted H's. So both the vertices and the edges, so all loops have to be in also. Okay, they can have very small weight, but they all have to be in. Okay, so ground state energy. The ground state energy, it turns out, is just the minimum of this divided by V squared. And an example would be the max cut density. So this is the graph H. If you want to do a max cut, then E to the 0 is 1. So these are 1, okay? And E to the 1 is E, so that's E, and it's symmetric. And the energy here is simply the max cut density. And this is an easy lemma. This quantity that I defined is the energy. And note that it's not the free energy, it's just the ground state energy. The entropy has been wiped out by the normalization. If we had normalized the energy by 1 over the volume, and then just divided by 1 over the volume after taking the log, then I would have had the energy and the entropy. This is just the energy. So this kind of convergence is the same as convergence of the ground state energy for all soft core models. So here we go. First half of the talk talked about subgraph left convergence, which is subgraph density convergence, metric convergence, and the fact that for all testable Fs, this is convergent and showed that these were the same. What we just said was that this kind of naive right convergence is the same as the ground state energy being Cauchy. And it turns out, it's a lot of work, that you can show that metric convergence does imply this because you can show that E of G and J is continuous in the cup metric. Or, if you're a theoretical computer scientist, you can show that cut densities are testable parameters. There are lots of pieces of work on things. However, we cannot turn this around. It's not true that this can be turned around, which is why we call this naive right convergence. Oh, there's also something else, which is quotients modding out by some ready partitions and stuff. Okay, we're almost done here. So, microcanonical ensemble. It turns out what you need to do is you need to restrict the number of sites in each color class. So I don't just want to tell you, the what easing model energy is. I have to tell you how many pluses and how many minuses you're going to have in easing model, or how many red, blue, and green sites you're going to have. And if I do that, then I can define a microcanonical homomorphism number, which is, again, a weighted count, where I tell you what fraction have to be in each color, and a corresponding microcanonical ground state energy. So here are some examples. And as I said, all the things that Mark was talking about and others you can do in this way. So right convergence is now that this converges for all fractions of red, green, and blue, or pluses and minuses, and all models, all soft core models. And this is equivalent to convergence of the microcanonical ground state energies. So this is what we already had, except here now I've told you that you have to have a certain percentage of red, green, and blue here. And then I've talked about right convergence. And it turns out with lots and lots of work, okay, you can turn this around. You have complete equivalent. Convergence of all subgraph frequencies is the same as convergence on all of microcanonical ground state energies in all soft core models, which is not a priori apparent at all, I think. Okay, so the summary, this was the summary of the first part, and the second part says that all of this stuff is also equivalent to a dual notion of convergence of microcanonical ground state energies of soft core models, and also, if you like Samarity partitions, which a lot of people do, convergence of quotients that you get by modding out Samarity partitions.